Oh, yes, so we're going to proceed with the last talk of this first day of the colloquium, and so we're very, very happy to have as our second keynote speaker Raphael Lozano-Hemmer. And I'm sure most of you, or at least many of you, do know the work of Raphael. Raphael is a media artist and who's actually Montreal-based, but who's showing his work increasingly internationally. So today he's going to be presenting his recent interactive installations, which are at the intersection of architecture and performance art. And he's using, as some of you already know, he's using technologies such as robotics, computerized surveillance, and telematic network. That he creates, and through this he creates platforms for public participation. So Raphael Lozano-Hemmer has shown his work, as I mentioned, internationally. He has been recently, his work has been presented at as a solo exhibition at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, also at the Fondación Telefónica in Buenos Aires, and the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney. He was the first artist to officially represent Mexico at the Venice Biennale with an exhibition at the Palacio van Hexel in 2007. He has also shown at biennales, triennales in Havana, Istanbul, Liverpool, Montreal, Beijing, Moscow, New Orleans, Seoul, Seville, Shanghai, Singapore, and Sydney. His work is in collections such as MoMA in New York and Jumex in Mexico, Daros in Zurich, and Tate Modern in London. So it's a, as I mentioned, a real pleasure to have you today with us, Raphael. And so I don't know if this is the title of your presentation, but I have here as a note, anti-modeler research. So please join me in welcoming Raphael.
Thank you so much, Christine. Thank you to everybody who organized this, Tamar as well, and it's a delight to be here. I have my notes in a Air Canada vomit bag, so it's very, very participative, very interactive. Today, for my presentation, what I thought I'd do is I would concentrate on interactive practices in artistic contexts. It's possible, I'm not sure, because sadly I missed this morning's panels. The connection, as you may know, was not working, but I'm pretty sure that the approach that we've had so far in the symposium and for the rest of it is quite critical, and as it should be. Participation is one of those ideas that whose hype is so intense that it needs to be, you know, moderated with a good dose of irony, cynicism, and humor and absurdity. But I did decide that what I would do is in the presentation today, I would show you, I've been working for about 20 years making interactive artworks where participation is a vehicle for transformation. I've talked for a long time about how my works are platforms for people to self-represent, for people to generate content, for people to engage in a certain type of intimacy through the artwork into different subjects from architecture to performance to history to politics and so on. And today what I'll present is just a subset of what I've been doing, pieces where I think participation is an interesting, you know, sort of element or fundamental element in the development of the artwork, leading all the way to some statements that I'll make at the end about that are very utopian or idealistic and certainly out of fashion about the importance of participatory work. While keeping a healthy dose of cynicism. The most important thing that I can say about participation in art is that participation in art is only valid, in my opinion, if it's out of control. This is the single most important thing that I think every artist who's working with participation needs to highlight, and that is your work cannot have a prescriptive, sort of determinism. It needs to be, by definition, out of control. So we're going to start. Recently, I had a solo show in Paris with 12 installations, which each one of them featured a camera. It was a surveillance camera that was detecting the presence of participants. We've been doing this tracking artworks for, like I said, about 20 years. And one of the things that annoys me when I am often presenting this kind of work is people come up to me and they talk about, I'm sure it annoys you too, I've never met someone who is not annoyed by this term, new media. They say, oh, this new media, you know, and you're working with high technology and whatever. And in Paris, I kept on quoting this woman right here, Marta Minujín. If you're not familiar with her, she was the very first artist, as far as I know and some theorists know, who used live video inside of an interactive installation. This was about 4 months before Nam June Paik got his Porta Pack. Marta Minujín was already working with these sort of live video feeds from cameras that would then mix the image of television with the live participants in the show, which was called La Minnesunda. The reason I like to start with Marta Minujín is threefold. The first one is because she's Latin American and a woman. So we break the stereotype of what it is that Latin Americans have to contribute in general to art. The second one, because it was 48 years ago, right? So 48 years ago of people putting cameras on live participants means that this is not something new. This is, in fact, something we could even talk about a tradition. It's a tradition, in this case, of Latin American installation art. There's many other kinds of histories that, you know, tell us the same story from Gutai in Japan, not just experiments in art and technology and the sort of experiments that took place here, but in Germany. Anyway, we're not going to go into media art history, but the point is, which we all know, is that there is a very sophisticated tradition of this kind of work. The third reason why I like to mention her is because her work was always based on this idea of being out of control. The piece itself is a performance event that had smell, that had people fucking, that it had, like, all sorts of intensities that, you know, you would walk through and become a part of. And this idea of a certain chaotic, a certain event-driven performance is something that I find very inspiring for the kind of production that I'd like to develop as I go along. So let's start right away with a project that was commissioned for the Schouwburgplein in Rotterdam in 2001. At the time, I did a scouting of the city, and I found this beautiful engraving by Samuel van Hoogstraten, which shows, you know, the sort of play of shadows that Rembrandt and Hoogstraten used to understand perspective. One of the things that I really liked, looking for the performative and for participation, is the idea that the large shadows were demonic, whereas the smaller ones were angelic and pure. And this relationship of scale to the monstrous and to otherness was something that we wanted to sort of explore. So we use this piece as an inspiration to set up a very large shadow play. This is a shadow play that covers 1,200 meters of interactive projections onto a building in the Schouwburgplein. It's basically a cinema. And what we did is we took two very powerful projectors, which would cast the pictures, the portraits of people in the streets of Rotterdam, projected onto the facade of the building, and then two very powerful projectors on the ground, which would basically wash out with bright light all of the portraits. So at any given time, if no one was crossing the shadow on the bottom, there would be nothing to see. As soon as you would cross the path of the projectors, your shadow would be cast onto the facade, and you could grow from 2 meters all the way up to 30 meters high. As you walk close to or far away from the facade, your representation, your shadow, would match the portrait of one of these people projected. And oftentimes we'd have this kind of game of representation, of becoming other. So we have people starting ad hoc participation performances with these portraits. Now, the pieces are, they don't have a beginning or an end. They don't have a narrative. They don't have a privileged viewpoint, like some kind of VIP proscenium. They also no one tells you what to do or not to do. It's all self-organized. So people discover by themselves that they can start this kinds of games of representation. And they, you know, begin doing them. It's a platform which exhibits a lot of flexibility because people have a lot of familiarity with what they can do with their shadow. A man on a wheelchair projected himself 30 meters and crushed everybody under his wheels and derived a lot of pleasure from this. We had Tuesdays was methadone night at the nearby church, so all the drug addicts would come and prance around. The technology that we were using in 2001 was computer vision. We would look at where the shadows were. This is a very old version of it. It's much bit more ominous now. And when the detection of the shadow would happen, we would make sure to notice when there was an overlap between the portrait and the shadow. And that's the moment that we would trigger a small little feedback sound in public space, like tick, just to let you know that you had activated that portrait. And more importantly, that once all of the portraits in a given scene were revealed, automatically the system would switch to a new set of portraits, frustrating representation and inviting people to reorganize in the public space. So you see it here, these people kind of collaborate. They reveal everybody who's in the scene, computer blacks out, cues a new image, and then people reorganize in the space. Now, a project such as this, in terms of participation, it was, in my opinion, successful just by virtue of using an interface, which is the shadow, which is quite, you know, natural, let's say. There's nothing high-tech about this. It's really a project that is closer to the 19th century phantasmagorias. This idea of shadow play, of course, is something that culturally, you know, most cultures have a substantial history of shadow puppetry or shadow theater, and we all sort of play with our shadows at home. It's too bad. Can you see their faces inside of their shadows? I just don't know. It looks very dark. Yeah, okay. So anyway, sometimes what we would do too is we would project the interface, the tracking system, onto the public space so that people could see it. This is important to people such as myself because I'm a nerd and I want to know what's going on. We also call it the Brechtian moment, the moment where we reveal the mechanisms by which the system works. Truth is, most people don't really care. They just start playing with each other. With these technologies, and they start doing interaction. So people who don't know each other, this is one thing that we're really looking for, how to take over public space in a way that is other than shopping. So this woman tortured her boyfriend for about 3 hours. We're only going to show you 15 seconds. So let me just... And then it's Holland, so there's bikes and breakdancers and skateboarders. So a project such as this is meant to be a place for interruption of the normal ways in which we use our city. How do we create connective platforms for people to take over their city without this kind of corporate usage that these technologies are normally used for? I mean, they're very bright, expensive projectors. They're usually there to sell you something. These kinds of projects are ephemeral interventions. This one took place for 3 weeks every night, from 6 p.m. to midnight. And just as you would cross and cast your shadow, you would be a part of it. This kind of project is quite disappointing to people who are following the traditional Sol et Lumière spectacles, because Sol et Lumière has this cathartic structure, and usually a didactic or pedagogical structure, where you are taught something about the richness of the people. And even the best Sol et Lumières that I've seen, like the Moulin des Images of Robert Lepage, do this, and it's very annoying. Because ultimately, identitarian representation leaves out a whole bunch of other histories that are not being part of the representation in the first place. So the idea to try and crowdsource somehow the aesthetics of it, I'm not saying that this is a good example of it, but it's an attempt, I think is an honest way to create an open artwork that, you know, as I said, is out of control. So we've done this project in many, many, many different places, from Hong Kong to that was in Linz, anyway. And it changes very much depending on where you're presenting it and the time of the week and so on. Also with Shadows, a project that we recently presented at the SF MoMA, is a project which actually was performed right in this very room. It's a project with Shadows which actually allow people to tune different radio frequencies with their bodies. What had happened in 2003 is the Mexican government had shut down illegal or informal or pirate radio stations in Chiapas and Oaxaca, and the native population were using these radio technologies to actually create cohesive communities. And of course, the central government did not want this. They shut them down. And then the question became, how do we visualize this public space, which is an electromagnetic spectrum? And so the project's called Frequency and Volume. As you move from left to right, you actually are controlling radio frequency scanners, which scan any signal from 150 kilohertz to, I think, 1.5 gigahertz. No, actually, 2.5 gigahertz, sorry. So that means that you can eavesdrop onto conversations on the phone. You can listen to air traffic control, FM, radio, taxi dispatch, any kind of signal that is out there. You can actually use your body to listen in on it. And this idea of participation, of course, does not come from, you know, 2003 when we first did this, but it comes from the Mexican estridentistas, which, if you're familiar with the work of the early Mexican futurists, Maples Arce and Icaza, they were actually the poets who were using the radio frequencies to generate this spread of manifestos over the towns. They have a manifesto for Antenna Man. And this is an inspiration for this work, where we're trying to say, well, how can we now make that tangible? So as you're moving around, you're controlling the equipment, and you yourself are becoming that target. And notice how in this project, like in all the other projects that I'm going to show you, participation is always a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, you have the seduction of inclusion and intimacy and of being able to interact with something. On the other hand, you have a policing, a targeting. You are tracked. This is, you know, this sibla, this target is very, very clear that you're being followed. And then at the same time, we're targeting those frequencies that are out there. So we are listening in on what is the ecology of the radio spectrum in whatever city it's presented. And of course, the answer is governments and corporations. But anyway, so that project has also been massively deployed. This is a 90-meter-long version we did at the Curve in the Barbican in London. If you know the history of participation in London, most good music, and I'm sure many of us enjoy British music, is possible thanks to pirate radio. It's possible precisely for the squatting of radio waves that pirate stations to this date in London exist. So the really experimental DJs, the people who are doing the good stuff that is out of the corporate, work in these and this interstices. And this project allowed us to tune into that radio spectrum ecology in England. So now, all of the projects that I'm showing you at first are about tracking. They're about detection. The idea is as follows. Minujin, but then Nam June Paik or Bruce Nauman or Julia Scher or Dan Graham, all of these incredible masters of video surveillance are very different than the video surveillance we're working with today. As you know, they were working with closed-circuit TV. The fundamental idea of closed-circuit TV is that behind that monitor, there's somebody, an authority figure, who actually makes certain choices and certain decisions about what he or she is observing. But today, as Manuel de Landa talks about in War and the Age of Intelligent Machines, there's been a delegation of executive control to the cameras itself. And today, our cameras are, in fact, got inside of them the prejudices of our society. So, for example, a camera today is automated to look for ethnic origin, or a camera today is trying to compare you to a database of suspicious individuals. So how can we as artists disrupt a little bit that sort of set of prejudices that is imbued into the camera? So one way to do it is to actually try and make it evident, to make the surveillance tangible. This project is called Standards and Double Standards, and it's a crotch tracker. It looks for crotches. And then as it finds a crotch, the computer sort of displays in a little monitor. But there are 50 military belts that are suspended at waist height in the exhibition room. And as you walk in, the computer starts controlling animatronically all of these belts in such a way that when you walk in, they all check you out. And then you say, okay, that's weird, so you move away. And they keep checking you out. And so if there's a lot of people, the way that these belts are going to start moving is very different, because a belt that is in between you and I might actually get stuck in an eddy, or, you know, there might be some sort of emergent movement coming out of the array of belts. But the important thing, again, is that this is not random movement, and it's also not pre-programmed movement. It's all to do with what kind of presence exists in the space. And, of course, the fun part of it, if you will, is trying to play with this idea of absence and presence, of who is the observer and who is the observed. And doing so with what I thought was a very fetishistic symbol of male paternal authority, you know, these belts. Though a friend of mine who's from Spain saw the piece and thought it was very homoerotic, which is fine by me. He likes to have 50 guys checking him out. So that's all right. So that's this project. In the same sort of tradition of trying to make tangible the observation, a lot of artists, not just myself obviously, but entire sort of generations of artists, are working with computer vision, and then using this as the subject itself of the artworks. So in a project called Subtitle Public, there is nothing to see in the room. You walk into an empty room, there is nothing. And as you sort of walk, the computer detects you and it subtitles you. So she now has the word tastes on her body. And as she walks away or around, that word just follows her wherever she goes. The only way to get rid of a word is to touch somebody else, in which case you exchange words with him or her. It's not possible to read your own words, so you depend on somebody else to tell you what kind of brand you've received, which makes the interface a little bit more connective, because then people start talking to each other, which is not normally the case in a museum. All the words are the verbs of the language conjugated in third person. So bites, laughs, sleeps, whatever. And I always tell this funny story. When we opened this project in Mexico City, an important Mexican politician got the word masturbates, and he was mortified by this word. And I told him, it's like, it's all the verbs, not some verbs, all of them. And then I showed him how to wipe off the word onto somebody else. And then he got the word coordinates, and he was all happy with that. He didn't want to touch anybody anymore. So that was funny. So let me just fast forward. So the guy on the top has the word institutionalizes. The guy on the bottom has the word marries, esposa. So as he touches him, institutionalizes, passes on, and then he gets a new word, winks. So these projects, they're very much about augmenting, of course, about augmenting our presence, about how to have a relationship that is not behind a screen with a quantified, with a metric, with a recording, with an archive. And in that sense, it reminds us of Bioy Casares' wonderful 1941 novel, Morel's Invention, which, if you haven't read, is a wonderful book, where the protagonist falls in love with a post-photographic woman. It's basically a recording. And I won't tell you how it ends. They've just re-released it in English. It's a wonderful sci-fi movie. Novel. And inspired by that, we developed this tracking system, this piece called Underscan, where you find these people inside of your shadow, but when you find them, they find you. So they check you out. And for as long as you're standing in front of them, they stay just checking you out, not like a loop. We call it scrubbing the playhead. So it kind of slows down and goes forward at different speeds, and it just sort of keeps on checking you out. And if you're not interested in a particular portrait that you have found, you can walk away, and the portrait will go back to sleep and disappear. We have over 1,000 portraits taken in the cities where we've shown this project of volunteers, which can be projected in a large area like 2,000 square meters. And so you see here, like, for instance, this guy walks away from this character, she goes back to sleep and disappears. And then there's no guarantee, there's no way to know where people are going to appear. So oftentimes the volunteers themselves would look for themselves and not find themselves. And if they did, it was straight out of David Lynch. Now, in this project, I often say that my work is as big as my insecurities. And, you know, and now I go to psychotherapy, so I'm also doing little things. Back here, I wasn't in psychotherapy, so this is the world's largest projector. It's casting the shadow of all the passersby in the square onto the ground. And then we had these robotic projectors, which had just come out in 2005, which could move and locate the portraits very accurately over the entire area. And most importantly, we had this camera, which would actually not just detect where people were, but predict where people would be in the future. So you see those crosshairs over there, that's where people would be following a trajectory. And that information we would use because we didn't want the portraits to follow you. We wanted you to encounter them. So we would find out where you were going to be, and we would place a portrait in your path, and chances are that you would find it. Of course, all of this technological sort of control is not necessarily important to the experience of the piece. What we cared about is that you would just sort of find people inside of your shadow that were the right scale, the right rotation, the right deformation, and that it just sort of worked magically. In terms of concept, this project came right after the London bombings, and I was very concerned that, you know, what we were doing in this project is projecting thousands of mostly young people from the city, onto the ground, and there was this kind of relationship of power. But fortunately, the videos that came out of the workshops were actually very strong. They had a lot of agency themselves. So these are some of the thousands of videos that were recorded in community centers, outside rock concerts and museums and whatnot. The local filmmakers would invite the public, they would explain what it is that we were doing, and people were invited to do whatever they wanted to do, to self-represent. The only thing we asked them is at one point, look straight at the camera. And that's the point that we trigger when you discover them with your shadow. So most people are just waving or doing sign language or dancing. It's England, so of course people take off their clothes. I don't know if you've ever noticed that British people, they like to get naked, so that's fine. The Yukon guy does a little dance. I mean, this kind of thing. And He says, you look because I'm not homeless. So while the project may not have the sophistication of the masters of video like Pipilotti Wrist or Gary Hill and Will Viola and whatever, the project does have immediacy. It has a sense of relationship, especially because, as I was saying, all of the portraits are from the city itself. So this is Underscan. Everything that I've presented up to now comes, I guess, under a certain heading of detection and tracking. You know, your participation in all of these projects is really, you know, I'm sure you are all mortified when you go into a stage and somebody asks for a volunteer or something like that. There's nothing more horrible than participating in an event. So that we must keep that very clearly in our heads as we develop these projects. And instead of tracking just the public, we started working in 2006 with a more, I know it sounds horrible, but crowdsourced approach. The idea that the entire content of the project needed to be live, generated by people themselves. So this is a project which is now here at the Musée d'Art Contemporain, and it's a project called Pulse Room, Almacén de Corazonadas in Spanish, which is basically hundreds of light bulbs which represent the heartbeats of people who hold on to a sensor. So basically, you have something not unlike what you might find at a gym. You hold on to these sensors, and your heartbeat gets translated into light. Now, the way that this project worked is as follows. At the beginning, we have nothing, and I start because I'm narcissistic and megalomaniac. So that's my heartbeat. When I release the heartbeat, the computer records it, and it puts it in the very first light bulb in the array. So that's me. Now here comes a second participant who is the mother of the sponsor. Now check out how her heartbeat is different in heart rate, but also the attack on the tungsten filament is different. You have systolic and diastolic activity all mapped into the actual light bulb to create something that looks more like a signature, unique pulse. When she releases the sensors, again, her heartbeat now goes to the first light bulb and mine gets pushed down one position. Here comes my friend who drinks a lot of Red Bull. So this is what Red Bull does to your heart. Boom, 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 boom. And again, he pushes all of the recordings down one position. Now here comes the curator. If you're ever curious about what happens inside of the heart of a curator, he thinks we're going to electrocute everybody. And so this is what happens in the curator. Boom, 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 boom. And then once 100 people in this particular version, once 100 people participate, the entire room is surrounded or filled with the vital signs of the past 100 participants. And crucially, after 100 people participate, your own heartbeat disappears from the room like a little memento mori. The project is not pleasant. It's also not stroboscopic, like it's not going to give you a seizure. But the idea is to create a very minimal environment, similar perhaps to the repetitive sequences of minimal composers like Mexican Conlon Nancarrow or American Steve Reich, Glenn Branca, and Phil Glass, or so on. The project itself has been presented in different kinds of scales. So, for example, this is another version of Pulse interface, this time in a city. So this is Pulse Park in Madison Square Park in New York City. This time, it's 200 theatrical spotlights, which are actually beaming the heartbeat of people. And as I was saying in the first public art piece that I showed, what I'm really interested in doing is how do you keep people in public space without them just being commuting from one spot to the next or shopping. And this kind of project is a very eccentric project where people would just come and hang out and be surrounded by heartbeats. Again, when you release the sensor, first light bulb keeps your heart recording. Everybody before you gets pushed down one position. And I should mention that this project is inspired by Macario, which is a movie from 1951 where the protagonist has a hunger-induced hallucination, and he sees everybody who's alive represented as these tiny little flickering candles And I thought that that was a very sort of romantic way to represent people. And one more pulse. This one is a sensor used typically at the border in the States or anywhere else for identification purposes. Here is your fingerprint. And as you stick your finger, not only are we getting recording your fingerprint, we're also with the digital microscope getting all the gunk. You see how dirty it is. And we're also measuring your heartbeat with an electrocardiogram. And then we record it, and every time someone participates, we push all of the memories down one position. In this particular version that you're seeing here, we had 10,900 different fingerprints represented at one time in the screen. Fine. So, the art that I'm most moved by is oftentimes art that is done in relationships to commissions of very horrible events, like, for example, the work of Johann Goetz or Krzysztof Łodyżko, Hans Hacke's Rachel White Reed, and so on. I got an opportunity to do a project like that. It was to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the massacre of students in Tlatelolco in Mexico City. If you're familiar with what happened, is the Mexican government, the soldiers, murdered somewhere around 300 different peaceful students 10 days before the Olympics. And the square where this took place actually was cleaned up of all the blood that very night, and then the media was complicit with the massacre. Nobody talked about it. And so for the actual project, if I can get a bit of sound, oh, there we go. For the actual project, what we did is we developed a megaphone which converted people's voices into flashes of light. And as you speak, your voice hits the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The voice, the participation is completely unmoderated and uncensored. It's an open mic. Anybody can come and convert their voice into light. And it was very touching because we had survivors. We had a fellow who said, you know, I'm here to say that my father is one of the soldiers who committed the massacre, and I'm a new generation. I come here to express my sadness about it. We had a fireman who said, you know, my name's so-and-so, and I'm here to denounce that routinely the Mexican government asked us to put coloring, anilina, onto our water tank so that when we would spray protesters, they would be easily identified. And I became a fireman because I wanted to protect people, not be part of the apparatus of oppression. It was just unbelievable, nonstop, really, really touching testimony, which, you know, makes me be a little bit less cynical about the usage of participatory platforms, because ultimately, in a place such as Mexico, the media is still complicit with power. As you know, PRI is back in power. Anything that we can do to interrupt that hegemony is a good thing. Now, when you would speak, there would be other searchlights which would bounce your sound, your voice, onto the rest of the city. So as you were driving down or you were looking out your window, you would see these flashing lights. You could see them from about 15 kilometers away. And you could actually tune in to 96.1 FM, is Radio UNAM, the university radio station, to listen live to what the lights were saying. And this was a really important part because, you know, it's not enough to just have the lights, you know, just flashing this memorial, but also for people to be able to hear through the media what it was that people were saying. So because it was a radio program, ultimately, one of the problems or one of the issues that we had is that sometimes people would not use the mic. There would be this quiet moments and the radio, you know, can't accept that. So what we would do is we would play back memory from the actual tragic event. So from survivors and poets, intellectuals from 68, who would then be mixed with the live participation. So the idea of remembering this is not trying to, you know, have this necrophiliac event to remember the dead and to love them, but in fact to talk about the situation now. So not the massacre of 68 only, but also the massacre of Acteal in 71, or any number of events that are taking place in Mexico right now. Now, the project was live for 3 weeks, and it wasn't all memorials and so on. We also got rappers and policemen, poets and children, and marriage proposals. A lot of my work gets marriage proposals. So that's Voz Alta. And I should say also, Voz Alta, again, very important, is to say there is an incredible poem from 1927 by Icaza called Magna Voz, which is, again, the Stridentista poets, which specifically talks about this enormous loudspeaker at the top of Popocatépetl Mountain, which would actually give the speeches, and it'd be the speeches of the public. So, again, ways in which we can connect what we're doing now to the precedence of participatory culture. All right, we have 4 more hours, so don't worry. I'm getting close. So this is a funner project. This is a project in Santa Monica Beach. What you see there is a crane with 2 powerful projectors, and on the sides are 2 large sandboxes. 2 sandboxes, anybody could come up to them, and you would stick your hand into the sandbox. And as you did that, it would be relayed onto the beach in Santa Monica, and they would see you nice and large. At the same time, we were using infrared tracking to track the people on the beach, and you see those black dots on the sandbox? That's the people on the beach. So you could see them, and they could see you. And that was done with very beautiful computer tracking from one of Dick Cheney's companies. This idea that, you know, the surveillance that you might use to look for Mexicans at the border or teenagers at the shopping mall can be reused to create environments of connectivity like this. So, again, the whole project is out of control. It's very uncomfortable the first few minutes because it's very costly to set up a project like this, and if no one's participating, the sponsors look at me funny. But as soon as somebody starts playing, everybody sort of gets in on this idea of taking over the platform. A project such as this is touring, so this project is now going to be presented in Rio, and it's LA, so people bring their little doggies with boots, as is normal. And then let me fast forward so we don't get bored. Do-do-do. This guy likes to burn people, for example, so he's like So there's that Coca-Cola guy. All right, so it's more of a carnival piece. So this is Sandbox. And then on the subject of crowdsourcing as well, this is a scanner, not unlike what you might find at an airport. You put your stuff, the piece is called Please Empty Your Pockets, and the conveyor belt takes it into the scanner head, records it, and then as it emerges from the other side of the scanner head, it comes out with an image of itself and the image of other stuff that people have put into the scanner in the past. So the system remembers 600,000 different items that you may have placed in the conveyor belt. And the content of the piece is just whatever people put into the conveyor belt. So we showed this first in England, and you would not believe what British people carry in their pockets. Everything from knives to drugs to, I don't want to say, but incredible, really fun, a really fun project. And their portraiture, right? Like it's the portraiture of your museum visitors. So that's great. We had this idea of tracking and detection, then crowdsourcing content, and then there's a variety of projects that are more about a certain kind of madness, about a certain kind of almost death wish, if you will, or a reflection on things that I can't really explain with the voice. I'm not a words guy, so I don't really understand why I do these projects. This one is called Nave Solar. It took place in the Inquisition Church of Laboratorio Arte Alameda in Mexico City. This is where a lot of heretics got killed during the Inquisition in Mexico. And we placed a large 6-meter diameter sphere, which we projected with live equations that simulated the surface turbulence of the sun. And hanging from this, we had a pendulum, which would take the public 17 meters across the nave of the full church. And when you would stand in it, your shadow would also be cast and generate this parametric smoke, which is actually mapped smoke. It actually accumulates on the top of the church. And what I was trying to do is create this kind of aquelarre, like a sort of witchcraft sort of scenario, in a particularly dangerous interface, which was this pendulum. Mexico is great because if you fall and you break a leg, people go up to you and say, "Are you all right? Oh, that must have hurt." And then that's it. Whereas if you do it anywhere else, you get sued and whatever, you know. But I love in Mexico, it's just common sense. It's like, oh yeah, be careful. You could break your leg. But yeah, the project is, you know, as you are in this pendular position, it reminds you perhaps of the fact that in the Inquisition, one of the torture systems of the Catholics was to place a knife under the pendulum, and every time they would ask you a question, they would bring it down lower and lower so that it would actually sort of start very slowly cutting the heretic until whatever he or she confessed or whatever it is that they did. So there's that. I'm going to skip this one. And I'll talk about this one. For the Havana Biennial last year, we developed a little machine to preserve the breath of this woman, singer Omara Portuondo. She's the 85-year-old singer of Buena Vista Social Club, a real romantic voice, super strong woman, very funny. So she breathes onto the machine, onto the brown paper bag. They call it cartucho in Cuba. And then we connect the brown paper bag onto basically a machine, a respirator, which inflates and deflates the bag 10,000 times a day, which is the normal respiratory frequency for an adult at rest. This little number on the bottom left, which changes every time the machine breathes. And the machine also sighs 158 times a day. So the machine actually goes like that. And the idea with this project is that when Omara Portuondo dies, her last breath will still be in this machine, circulated between the bellows and the brown paper bag. When she dies, we are going to send this piece, which right now is being exhibited in New York, is going to go to the National Museum of Music in Cuba. So you'll be able to go to that museum to see her last breath. And next to the actual machine, we also have a little video showing how she actually did breathe into this machine to be preserved. So this is a biometric portrait of somebody. It's just a really ridiculous idea of preserving someone's breath. So with this idea, then we made another project because we learned a lot about respiration systems and bellows and so on. And the last project I'm going to show you is one that we just premiered in Istanbul, which is called Vicious Circular Breathing. So it's inspired a little bit by Last Breath, but it's an interactive or participatory project. What it is glass prism. It's a glass prism, 2.5 meters on side, which invites people to enter and breathe the air that has already been breathed by everybody before them. So it's completely hermetically sealed. You need to press a button to enter. Doors open. You go into a decompression chamber. The fresh air goes out. Another set of doors opens, and you walk into the main cavity of the place, and you sit down. And that's all you do. Before you walk in, there's a big sort of warning sign. There's three warnings. The first warning is asphyxiation. So we actually have carbon dioxide and oxygen sensors inside of the prism. If the levels get to a dangerous level, automatically the doors open up. The second is contagion. The system has absolutely no filters. So any germs or viruses or bacteria, airborne particles, whatever, you're going to be exposed to everybody who's been there before you. But we say this is not unlike what happens in an elevator. But we ask you not to be there more than 15 minutes. And the third warning is panic. In order to get out of the prism, you need to wait for the decompression sequence to also get out. But we have panic doors on the side, so you can actually push them out if you're in panic. So in this project, the breath goes out through that umbilical cord that you see onto a set of bellows. These are very similar to the bellows in an organ. And they're basically pushing the air from the room onto a system of, we call it the manifold, which is these valves that are controlled with electromagnetism, those little bearings on the right that you see. And then themselves are feeding 61 brown paper bags, each of which is actually breathing at its own rate. So the idea is using, again, the brown paper bag to create this tangible sort of representation of this shared commons, which is the stale air. And we use 61 because that's the norm, 5 octaves, so the number of keys in an organ, which inspired us. It's a disgusting project. I would never go in it. I was the first one to go in it. And then I just said, okay, see you guys later. But I made it so that it's actually attractive to just be outside. But the idea that participation leads to death is, one thing that I thought maybe, you guys would enjoy. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Raphael. So we have a first question from a student. So Irandi Vergara Vargas.
Thank you. Thank you, Raphael. Great presentation. I don't know where to start. We made a deal, I'll ask in Spanish, so I'm sorry, guys. No, it's a joke. I have a question. So I'll go with these last two works and try to compare or maybe intend to make you push forward the idea of participation. In work one, the spectator, anyone else will just observe the Omar Aportuondo's breath, and it's a kind of a living archive. And the second part, it implies danger, and it seems to me that participation, we have to pay a high price for participation. And I wonder if throughout the years you have become more, you use the word cynical a lot. And I wonder to what extent developing interactive and participatory works have pushed you to creating other kinds of works where there is more sense of danger and there is more sense of actually physical troubles.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the thing that I would emphasize the most is participation is manifold. There's different kinds of participation. I'm sure you already have enormous number of typologies presented here before. Within my work, there's projects which are more celebratory, projects that are more you know, sort of strategic in how critical I want to be. It really depends on where you're presenting. So, for example, in Istanbul today, as you may know, we have a situation where the Erdogan government is taking over Gezi Park, and you're getting Taksim protests on a daily basis, because one of the fundamental things that the people of Istanbul are saying is, here's a park, it's providing oxygen and memories and relationships, and you're replacing it with a shopping mall and these ballistic glass storefronts defining an inside and an outside, and we are always left out. And so in a situation like that, one must, in my opinion, try and create something that can reverberate to a political situation. Other times, you want to create some environment that will actually not connect you to any political situation. You need an interruption. You want an escape from these realities, and I think that art does do that at times. One thing that I find problematic is when artists are expected to produce a body of work that follows some kind of sort of agenda. Like, I like it when, you know, a novelist can at one point go from sci-fi to, you know, a biography to whatever it is that they feel actually conducts their message better. And I think that that is applicable to participation as well. I should say, though, one thing I just noticed in my notes, I don't know if you like this or not, I have no idea, but I wanted to say that the role of participation in art is to bring back the aura of art. So we all remember Benjamin saying, you know, the mechanical reproduction of art takes away the aura, right? Like, we no longer have the singularity in this artwork. But through interaction, through participation, this singularity comes back, and it comes back with a vengeance, because the reading of the artwork makes the artwork, and this is an irrepeatable and unreproducible moment. So I think that, you know, modernism is well sort of described by this maxim from Walter Benjamin, but today participation asks us to talk more about an inescapable field that we are aware of, not just of our own presence and participation, but also that the artwork itself is aware of its participation. And that's a real shift, in my opinion.
So
I just wanted you to know that I did read Walter Benjamin, in case you.
It has now a sort of a temporal dimension also.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's true.
Good. So.
Hello again.
Hi.
When you talk about your pieces being out of control, what do you mean exactly? Is it because you don't anticipate the audience's reaction to it, or can you expand a little bit on
Absolutely.
Out of control?
Yeah. It's in part because you don't want to be prescriptive over what will happen. So the possibility that the artwork will be interpreted in completely different ways that you had anticipated. But more sort of structurally also, there is a big misconception that media art is visual art. And we who are practitioners know that that's not true. Media art is performance art, is performing arts. In other words, we are not based in a timeline. There's this thing called time-based media that does not apply to us. We do a thing called event-based media, which is this idea that through these happenings, through this emergent sort of behaviors that take place, the project exists, and that it is impossible to reproduce. So one of the things that that I like to say is that, for example, media art is impossible to preserve, because it's out of control. But what you can do is you can perpetrate it. So preservation versus perpetration. The idea that the cultural act can be committed into the future under conditions which are experimental, right? Like, we don't know what the outcome will be. If you think about kinetic sculpture, for example, you have, if you thinking of kinetic sculpture, you have like Caldera mobile, right? So the mobile is moving with the wind. To an extent, there's a certain randomness to that movement. It's been explored beautifully by him and others. And then you have, on the other hand, you have, say, Paul McCarthy animatronic, which is like some guy banging a sheep or something. And then there is an actual sequencer, right? Like it's an actual sort of timeline that tells the system what to do. And then at the end of that, it loops back to the beginning and it repeats it. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is let's create something that can surprise the developers and the public, that can actually have behaviors of its own, that can have a radically different interpretation than what you originally imagined, because the artist has no monopoly over how the work is read. Duchamp said, "Le regard fait le tableau." And I love this. It's like, back then, we already knew that it was only in the act of reading or experiencing that we created the work. And so this out of control is about that. It's about me not being able to moralize or push a very specific viewpoint, when in fact what you want is to explode all of those viewpoints and be surprised over. And I only showed stuff that worked, but I have a lot of projects that totally tanked. Which I don't show because I'm proud. But that's important to know that the works fail, and that's a beautiful thing, as we all know.
Thank you, Rafa.
Thank you.
A lot of our colleagues are doing, you know, their art, but they're also doing opera, like you referred to Robert
Lepage
earlier. You know, he's doing installation, he's doing theater, he's doing opera, he's making films. You seem to have been sticking to a line of work. You say media work, participatory media work. And some people will argue that in more traditional art forms, there is a intense participation. For example, when you read a book, the book is really open to your imagination. You have you read the words, but you make up, you know, the set in a way, or you invent a lot of things. And people say that good art involves the participation of the reader, viewer, and everything. Do you think at one point you might be writing a fiction book or doing an opera, thinking that these are traditional media, but being happy with how they involve people's participation, or if you prefer to stick to a more like in-your-face type of participation?
No, I mean, I certainly would leave that open, and I am collaborating with a few performance artists, choreographers, singers. I've been working with beatboxers, for example, recently. But my position is to be a facilitator for them, so not so much have like a directorial line, but rather just be a collaborator with them. I do believe that one can say that, you know, participation is unavoidable, and that's a good thing, not necessarily a bad thing. I also note that, what did I want to tell you? Something about writing, linear. You see, this brain doesn't really work with linear. The responsibility of writing, it would be so high. I have a lot of respect for people who have that kind of focus, and I've noticed that I'm more like the kind of person who sort of puts together some kind of reaction. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. Thank God. So I'm very inspired by a guy called Frederick Chesky, who is like a Marxist composer from the United States. He's still alive. He had an incredible piece. I recommend you, if you can hear it. It's called Coming Together. It's from 1971. And it's a beautiful piece of music that, not to go into it, but the philosophy of Chesky is that there is something radical about people who don't know each other getting into a room and experiencing something together. And I think that there is something to be rescued from that, because it's important that when we look back at the 60s and the 70s, we don't just dismiss the sophistication of very simple messages such as that. I think that the performing arts, even if it's not interactive, as you said, you know, you are present, breathing the same air than the actor. And that creates community. It creates communion. It creates complicity. we exchange hormones. I mean, that we really need to do. So I don't see it as something that's completely separate. And I do hope that one day I can do some stuff like that. Yeah.
Hi, hello. Hi. I just wanted to pick up this thread. And I wonder if you know the work of Claire Bishop, the writer.
Yes,
on
I do.
Participation. Yeah. Yeah. And I just wondered because, you know, the account you've given us, which is, you know, wonderful, wonderful work, but, you know, is of, if you'll forgive me pushing it quite far, this is to push it very far, a kind of irresponsibility, like you put the thing out and then things happen and you inflame actions and forms of community and so on. And, I mean, Bishop's response to Bourriaud in thinking about relational aesthetics in those terms, which may be far from your work, is to say, look, you know, the artist has to be concerned because effectively the artist is designing. In designing the piece, the event that you create, you're designing a form of participation. And so she enjoins artists to take a concern with the nature of the responses and the forms of participation and precisely what is engendered for those participants and audiences that come into the work. And I just wondered whether, if I push you that far with Bishop,
please,
you know, that makes sense to you, that actually you do think quite carefully about the forms of participation you're engendering. And a last comment would be, you know, in some of those works, I know you wanted us to feel this. I mean, you're really subjecting these participants to, well, you know, like death, a couple of times in those works. So I just wanted you to say a bit more about your sure. design of this experience.
Sure. So a couple of quick notes. One of them is I think that Bishop's text on Bourriaud is so delicious. It's one of the best things I have ever read, specifically because it kind of shows the importance of a grounding, you know, and a critical bite. And it... having said that, I should mention that my use of the word relational predates Bourriaud. So I just wanted to say that it's important. Relational architecture, I called it, since 1995. His relational aesthetics came, I think, in 97. I've read the book. I have problems with it, like we all do. It's a bad word now to use relational, but before him, of course, there was Maturana and Barella, who were using it to describe neurobiology. Elio Clark and Ligiotti Chica were talking about relational objects, relational databases. There's so many other uses of relational, so I want to say that. So Claire Bishop's text on Bourriaud is very important for me because I feel a real rejection of the artists who, at that time, Bourriaud brought up. And in fact, so do they, by the way. I've talked to some of them. They're mortified. But having said that, Bishop's latest article in Art Forum about, you know, technology is outrageous. It is just so disappointing because here is somebody that I admire very much on her, you know, sort of position and backbone when it comes to critical thinking, and then she completely dismissed the entire field of media art, completely and absolutely. Its history, its present, its future, all of it. Just said, well, there's a thing called new media, but let's not talk about that. That's its own thing. Let's now talk about, you know, artists who are not really addressing technology. Well, she needs to, you know, open up and notice that most of us are, that we accept the challenge of working in a technological culture, and we have been doing that for a long time. Now, on the subject of design, I do believe that the artist has idiosyncrasies and biases and perversions and nightmares, and that these need to be followed very strictly, right? The only thing that I'm saying is that you do that with authorship, with a manifesto, if necessary. In fact, I have several manifestos. That passion you need to put out there. You need to have these best intentions, or you need to react with passion to, you know, what troubling you. But then you need to let go. The moment that you're presenting it with the public, you are establishing a collaboration which you no longer control. And this is very humbling. It's awful, in fact, because oftentimes if you are like me and you sort of get exposed to the market and now market forces come into play and whatever, it can be really take your soul out. So my position is we need to make manifestos with passion and then allow them to contravene.
Yes, hello. I think it actually ties in pretty well with this last question. You alluded to something that I understood to be testimonial from your subjects. To what extent do your participants or the participants in the media art world that you work with, to what extent do they have the opportunity to reflect on, I mean, I saw the megaphone and the speaker, but in your other works, which maybe are just more visual and regarde, as they say in French, but to what extent do they get the opportunity to reflect?
It depends on the project. So, for instance, a lot of my work, half of it, is in public space. And I love public space specifically because it gives you the capability to address publics which are not having expectations over how events should take place. In the museum or in the gallery especially, there is another problem, which is the lack of neutrality of this. Not that public space is neutral, sorry, I didn't mean that. But what I'm saying is in a museum, you have a culture and a didacticism and a pedagogy which you have to address as well somehow. And I find, sometimes the same question asked in these two different contexts has very different responses. So my practice is let's continue doing public art and also do pieces inside of museums, so long as the museum understands that what I'm doing is not visual art. What I'm doing is performing art.
So that will be it. Thank you very much, Raphael, for your generous talk. And so this is the last session of the day. And so please join us tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And we'll continue on the subject of visual arts, actually, in the first panel. Thank you.